Good morning. Ryan Hardman, registration number 37922 for Evan Lawler. May it please the court. This morning, I'd like to discuss issue one, the prior felony conviction rule. But if this court has other questions, I'd be happy about the other issues. I'd be happy to answer them. The fact that a witness has a prior felony conviction is relevant to impeach that witness's credibility. And the reasoning behind this rule is that a person who's broken the law in the past will not be deterred from lying in court by an oath, the threat of perjury charges, or other ethical norms against lying. As my evidence teacher put it in law school, the jury may conclude that because the witness has broken the law before, he might be willing to break the law again by testifying falsely under oath. So it's the fact of conviction alone, the fact that the witness has broken the law in the past, that's relevant to his credibility, that bears on his credibility as a witness.
Ms. Hardman, let me jump right in. And you make a very compelling argument, and I understand all the points that you make. Candelaria says, when a defendant exercises his statutory privilege of testifying, all prior felony convictions and their nature may be shown to impeach his testimony. How do we get around that, though? Obviously, that's from the Supreme Court. We're bound. They said all prior convictions and their nature may be shown.
May be shown. And the word may means that the trial court has discretion in what it admits about the prior felony conviction. Prior cases, prior Supreme Court cases, which are also binding, stress that the court has discretion about what information about the prior conviction that the trial court, or that the trial court must exercise its discretion in deciding what about the prior conviction it's going to admit. And Candelaria also says that if the defendant admits his conviction, it's not necessary to prove that conviction. And that goes back to the prior Supreme Court cases that say it's not necessary to admit more than the fact of conviction if the defendant admits it. If he denies the conviction or equivocates in some manner regarding the conviction, then the prosecution can go into more in order to prove the conviction.
When did he admit it in your case? When he was cross-examined by the prosecutor, right?
He offered to stipulate that he had two prior felony convictions out of the state of Florida.
When?
Before trial, before he testified.
And the prosecution rejected that stipulation. Is that right?
Yes, but even if the prosecution isn't willing to accept the stipulation, the court still has discretion, or should still have discretion, in deciding what about the conviction it's going to allow.
It's a little confusing to me, because obviously it doesn't come in unless he's going to testify. Did he say before trial he was going to testify?
Not before trial.
So, see, I'm not sure how the judge can even rule on that, because he stipulates the conviction if, in the event, he testifies?
Yes, it was a motion in limine to preclude that evidence if he were to testify. It went to his decision.
So when he testified, he knew that these were going to come in because the court had denied that motion. He knew that he faced this possibility that these were going to come in, right?
The court believed it did not have discretion. It said, I might very well limit this evidence if I thought I had discretion to do so, but I don't believe I have that discretion. The court said, well, I think I'm bound by the Court of Appeals decisions saying that the name comes in, and then right before he testified, defense counsel again renewed that motion and argued that motion again, and the court again said, I don't believe I have discretion to limit the name of the conviction.
So is it your view, Ms. Hardman, that there's no evidentiary value when you put it on for impeachment purposes to the nature of the conviction? I've read you said in the Old Chief case, and I look at that pretty carefully. That, I don't know, I'm not remembering now, it was felon in possession or something like that, where the only true relevance was the fact that you had a prior conviction.
Right.
And the court said, you already stipulate to that, we don't need to hear any more. But my memory is, and it's been a little while since I've read the case, and I apologize, but I think Olchie talks about, you know, other cases where the nature may have some evidentiary relevance. So would you address that? Here, you know, it seems like the nature of the crime may well have some relevance for impeaching that would be greater than just the fact of the conviction.
The prosecution didn't admit it for any other purpose but to show that he had a prior felony conviction. So there's no record about what his prior conviction, if it was a crime of untruthfulness or truthfulness. Old Chief says that where you're just talking about legal status, where it's just the legal status that's relevant. And in Old Chief, the legal status in that case is relevant to an element to show that he was a prior felon in possession of a weapon. Here, the legal status is relevant to impeach the credibility.
But isn't there a difference? That's what I was trying to get to. Do you see a distinction, for example, if someone has a prior, you know, felony conviction for some kind of, what we call in my evidence class, criminal falsity, a crime, you know, that suggests falsity, whether a criminal fraud kind of case or something like that, that would suggest more, goes more to credibility than some other, arguably some other felony. Isn't there a distinction? No, Mike, go ahead.
Then the court could move, or the prosecution could move to admit it under 608B prior specific instances showing credibility, or I'm sorry, character for untruthfulness. But here the prosecution didn't seek to admit it under 608B. The prosecutor moved to admit it just simply under the prior felony conviction rule. And what I wanted also to say about Old Chief is it talks about how sometimes the nature might be relevant, but where you're only talking about, where only the status is relevant, and the name of the conviction would lure the jurors into a sequence of bad character inferences, it fails 403. Here, the court acknowledged that the name of the conviction presented a 403 nightmare, but he felt he had no discretion.
Ms. Hartman?
Yes.
Sorry to interrupt you. I understood your opening brief to make the point that the name and nature of the conviction is not relevant. And I'm wondering if, first of all, if I understand you correctly, that's your argument. And I wonder how that squares with Candelaria, which even if though it uses the word may be admitted, it seems to suggest at least relevance under 401. Is your argument that it's not relevant, or even though it is relevant to some degree, it should be, or perhaps should be excluded under 403?
The prior conviction itself, the fact of conviction, is relevant. Here, the name, failure to register as a sex offender, is not relevant to his credibility. But even if you disagree with that, it fails 403. In Old Chief, it said they were talking about like a mitomis that showed the name of conviction. And they said the document showing the conviction and the name of conviction is relevant to prove the prior conviction, but it failed 403. Here, I think we're just talking about a question, do you have a prior felony conviction out of Florida? That is relevant to go on and say, and it's for failure to register as a sex offender, is irrelevant and highly prejudicial.
Well, other than the one question the prosecutor asked him, was there any other discussion about this prior offense? I mean, it came in, there was a question, he says yes, I was convicted. Then they moved on to other things. They didn't ask them about the offense, did they?
Not the circumstances of the offense,
right,
no. But they got in front of the jury that he's a sex offender. And
well,
that
they
is
got
so
a couple other things in front of the jury. Did this defendant actually give a statement to the police when he was arrested?
Yes.
And that was played for the jury, wasn't it?
It was.
And in the statement, he admitted killing the victim, didn't he?
That's what he's on trial for. But it's not his prior conviction.
No, I'm just asking. There's other evidence. I mean, you're talking about the prejudice from the mention of the sex offender conviction. I'm wondering about how is it harmful at all, given all the other evidence against him, including, if I understand correctly, he admitted that he committed the murder, and he even admitted that he thought about it, or that it was almost that it was premeditated. He actually admitted that on his statement.
How is this any kind
of error that makes a difference in this case?
He admitted killing the victim, but his statements about his mental state were ambiguous and conflicting. He said he snapped. It brought back a flood of emotions. And to me, the way I read his statements about his mental state are they're going to say it was premeditated. There, he was imagining how it was going to play out.
He was envisioning his defense, wasn't he?
But he testified at trial that he acted under a heat of passion. And to tell the jury that he is a sex offender, I see prejudice for four reasons. First, the court said it was a 403 nightmare, which I think the court agrees is prejudicial. The status first of being a sex offender is highly stigmatizing, which the trial court recognized. It lures the jurors into that sequence of bad character inferences that the Supreme Court talked about in Old Chief. I don't think it comes across strongly enough in the briefs that the facts of this case are sexually charged and involved repeated sexual advances by Mr. Lindeboom, which Mr. Lawler had tried to say no. The jury's knowledge that Mr. Lawler is a sex offender could lead them to believe Mr. Lawler initiated the contact or to disbelieve his testimony that he was highly provoked by Mr. Lindeboom's sexual advances. I also think it's prejudicial because to say that he's his prior convictions are for failure to register as a sex offender, but not to say that to explain what his sex offenses are, which I mean, I also clearly do not want, but it shows the jury that there is information being withheld from them, which would lead the jury to speculate about what those offenses were, how many offenses they were, what they involved.
But that's the defense counsel could have clarified that if there was something positive to show. Like if his failure to register was, I put the wrong, we get some really weird cases during failure to register. I put the wrong address down, and he was prosecuted for that. Of course, the defense could have shown that that's all it was.
But she shouldn't have to. And it's not the failure to register itself that's prejudicial. It's the sex offender, the label, and the stigma that goes with being labeled a sex offender. It's also prejudicial because his credibility was so crucial to the defense. As you note, his statements in his interview were conflicting, but at trial, he testified about how he felt and that he acted under a heat of passion.
Ms. Hardman, on that question of heat of passion, I understand that was his defense to the homicide charge. What was his defense to, after the homicide, stealing the property and stealing the truck? And obviously, he didn't argue that was done in the heat of passion.
Right.
So how did he work that in together with his other defense?
That's a good question. And then I'm more focused on the homicide. And
that's
sorry,
fine.
I don't remember what his defense was to the taking of the property.
That's okay.
And even if this court disagrees that the error was harmful, this court should clarify this area of law and tell district courts that they do in fact have discretion in this area to decide what about the prior convictions they will admit. I'd like to save the 2 minutes that I have for rebuttal. Thank you.
You may.
Good morning, may it please the court. My name is Gabriel Olivares, attorney registration number 45336, and I represent the people in this matter. I'd like to pick up where Ms. Hardman just left off, and that's with prejudice and harmless error. The defendant's entire theory of the case was heat of passion, but before the jury could even consider heat of passion, they had to determine whether the defendant committed first or second degree murder. And then with the evidence and the testimony in this case, no reasonable jury could have acquitted the defendant of first degree murder. All of the evidence about what happened on the night in question came from the defendant. He testified and confessed that he and the victim had consensual sex 2 nights before, and that he contacted the victim to hang out. Afterwards, on the second encounter, afterwards the victim picked up the defendant and they went back to the victim's apartment where they watched television, drank beers, and sat close on the couch. The defendant admitted during trial that given the circumstances of the previous encounter and his own initiation of the contact, that the victim could have reasonably expected that something of a sexual nature would again happen. And the victim put his hand on the defendant's thigh. The defendant rejected this advance, saying, "I'm not having this tonight. I'm not getting down like that." And the victim stopped. 10 to 15 minutes later, the victim put his hand on the defendant's thigh again. Defendant shoved his hand away and said, "What the hell?" The defendant admitted at trial he was not going to let this go. But he did not immediately attack. He admitted at trial that he pondered it, and the more he thought about it, the more worked up he got. So he waited until the victim stood up, he waited until the victim walked away, and he waited until the victim had his back turned. But then he admitted that he needed to protect himself just in case the victim fought back. So he took off his t-shirt, wrapped it around his right arm, and with his arm protected, he crept up on the victim, because as he admitted in trial, he didn't want to make noise or commotion which would give himself away or prevent him from carrying out his plan.
When you say he admitted this at trial, this is the interview with the detective, or this is his live testimony?
His live testimony. That's page 41 of the February 17th transcript. He admitted that. Then he wrapped his right arm around the victim's neck, locked it in place with his left arm, used his weight to pull the victim on the bed, and then wrapped his legs around his body so that the victim couldn't kick free.
But this all did happen in a very rapid period of time. I mean, I definitely understand your argument. He himself said in the interview, I think it was, "Oh my goodness, I have deliberation," and he recognized the problem. But it happened in a short span. I mean, it seems to me he had a non-frivolous argument here. You know, he said the word, I think, "I snapped." And he had all this prior, you know, abuse as a kid or whatever he talked about. And so, I mean, there is some evidence here to support a heat of passion defense, is there not?
Sure. And the heat of passion defense was given. Now, whether or not the jury would have agreed to it had they decided to convict him on second-degree murder is probably unlikely because of the objective component of heat of passion.
I definitely understand, right? Mr. Olivares, given the time is somewhat short, I want to turn to ask you about the Candelaria case myself. Is it your position that the court has no discretion at all, even under 403?
Yes, the statute gives the conviction and its name relevance, and so the conviction and its name do not pass through the 401 or 403 test.
But explain to me what the relevance is here. I mean, Ms. Hardman says with some force, why did the jury need to hear he has two prior convictions for sex offense? I mean, it was, or obviously his failure to report, but the jury is going to easily assume he's got, you know, various sex offenses in his past. What was the relevance that he had two prior sex offenses? There's no, you know, I guess that's the point. I mean, could you not see a situation where the prior crime was so bad that it would obviously prejudice the jury? I mean, how can you say the court has no discretion whatsoever?
Well, first, both Yeager and Hubbard say that, and the Supreme Court said that in Yeager and Hubbard. Yeager says that the word may in the statute connotes authorization to the parties. It does not speak of the grant of permission or discretion to the trial judge to receive or reject proof. Hubbard is a little more direct. It says the decisions interpreting the statute, however, have not granted the trial judge discretion to foreclose the use of prior felony convictions to impeach a defendant's testimony. And the question, the first question you asked about what is the relevance? The relevance comes from the statute, and the legislature has said this evidence is relevant, so it does not have to pass through the 401 test. And I cited a couple cases, Hadley and Arnold, in my opening brief, and they said there is a difference between convictions of different crimes. There's a difference between a conviction of first-degree murder and a conviction of second-degree assault or some, you know, F6.
Sure, and that makes some sense to me on the relevance piece, but how do we get, and I'm just struggling a little bit intellectually on how we say we could never do a 403 analysis. So I get you get to 401 and 402 here. Why is it that this, and what in the statute says 403 is irrelevant?
The way the statute's been interpreted is that it may be introduced, so that the trial court, and having interpreted that as the trial court has no discretion, means that a 403 test won't be performed, because a 403 test is a balancing test, so it requires discretion. In Gomez, which I believe cited Judge Hand, said whether or not the jury uses the conviction for an inappropriate purpose, improper purpose, is not an open question to the court. The only question is whether it was permissible to be used for impeachment purposes, and it was.
Mr. Olivares, sorry to interrupt you. Just following up on Judge Gabriel's question, it's certainly true that some of the cases from this court have said the trial court has no discretion. Those seem to follow Candelaria, which has been discussed, uses the word may. This may be admitted. That's from the Supreme Court. Do you think when the court said use the word may, they meant must? Or how do we get from may to must, which I think is where you are?
Well, and Yeager and Hubbard are both from the Supreme Court, I believe. So
those, I'm sorry, did those predate Candelaria or come after?
They're all around the same time. They all came out in 72, 73. So and since then, this court, divisions of this court, has said the trial court may not foreclose the use of the name. And Candelaria also cites to a few cases before that. And one of the cases, first of all, Candelaria, the question that they found proper was, Mr. Candelaria, you were convicted of a felony on the 5th of March, 1963, and that was an armed robbery, was it not? And they said that question was proper for impeachment purposes. Ekus, which it cites, the defendant was asked if he had been convicted of felony larceny. And in Rauta, a Supreme Court case from 1948, the Supreme Court actually held that all of the facts become admissible when the defendant chooses to testify. I think the later decisions have limited that to say that the court has discretion over the circumstances of the crime, but not the name and nature. And the name and nature come from Dennison, which stated that once the defendant testified, the name and the fact of conviction and the name of nature of the particular crime may be brought out.
I think you may have just answered the question I was going to ask you, Mr. Olivares, but let me just check. So the way you harmonize the older Supreme Court cases, Ekus and Dennison, is when they talk about your views, when they talk about discretion, they're talking about all circumstances. The name and nature comes in, but the court has discretion, essentially, how much more I'm going to let in.
Exactly. And I think in Dennison, it has this paragraph about the name and nature, and then in the next paragraph, it talks about the discretion of the court to limit cross-examination or further inquiry into the circumstances. And in this case, even, the defendant actually started to get into the circumstances of the conviction, asking about, you know, where were you at the time that you failed to register? And the prosecution quickly approached the bench and said, if we're going to get into this, we're going to get into all of this. And the defense counsel pulled away because they didn't want to open the door. The defendant also relies heavily on Tarling, and I just want to speak about that real quickly. Tarling dealt with a case where the defendant was asked on the stand, did you ever desert from the Navy? And it said that was improper. But it made a distinction, saying the defendant may be proved to have been convicted of infamous crimes, but not have done other infamous deeds. If in this case the defendant had been asked, did you in the past fail to register as a sex offender in the state of Florida, that would have been improper. That would have been 404B evidence. The correct inquiry, and the inquiry that was made in this case, was, have you in fact been convicted of failure to register as a sex offender in the state of Florida? It's not the underlying crime that is relevant. It's the conviction for the crime, and that's what was went into in this case. And as was pointed out, it was the only mention of the conviction. There was no mention of it in closing arguments. So even if it was error, it could only have been harmless. The court has no other questions.
Let me ask you, while you've got 4 minutes.
Sure.
I'm curious, relating to one of the other issues that Ms. Hartman didn't talk about, which is the ex-girlfriend's reference to the prior domestic violence issue. And I know the court jumped in, and I know the court gave a curative instruction. that issue concerns me, obviously, and I know the prosecutor seems like did everything to good to have this woman don't mention this, and she does anyway. Why isn't that very prejudicial? Here, it certainly suggests this is a man of a violent nature. And that was the issue, and it totally undermined his defense. You know, is that the kind of, I have a concern whether that's the kind of thing where you can unring the bell. So would you address that issue?
Sure. So the testimony in there, the question was leading up, in the months leading up to the incident, you did not have the opportunity to observe the defendant. And that was a question on cross-examination by defense counsel. The only thing that the ex-girlfriend said was no, there was a restraining order. The restraining order, as the judge noted, there was no facts elicited about why there was a restraining order. There was no testimony whether it was a criminal or civil. And I think if you look at all the factors that are laid out in Everett and Scott, one, the prosecution did not deliberately elicit it. Two, it was ambiguous in pleading. Three, the trial court immediately gave a curative instruction. And finally, this was on rebuttal. And as Judge Richmond pointed out, there were extensive facts in this case that suggested, that outweighed this ambiguous remark. And the prosecution didn't make any mention of it in closing arguments. So a mistrial is a drastic remedy, and I think the curative instruction was more appropriate here.
Thank you.
Mr. Olivares, excuse me. May I take you back to the first issue, the conviction? I thought you said earlier that because the statute renders the conviction admissible, that forecloses any 401, 403 analysis?
Yes.
And I'm wondering about that conclusion, because of course we have a statute which allows introduction of similar transactions evidence, but nonetheless the Supreme Court has applied the Spoto analysis, part of which is a 403. analysis. So hasn't the Supreme Court applied 403 even to those matters which are also governed by statute?
So the 404B rule is a theory of relevance specifically, and it doesn't say, it has not been interpreted as not requiring a 403 analysis. The statute in question here, while also giving the evidence relevance, has been interpreted as removing the discretion from the court. So I think it goes down to the interpretation that's been in place for decades. 404B has never been interpreted to go outside Rule 403, whereas this statute has removed discretion from the trial court.
Thank you.
If there's no other questions, I'd ask the court to affirm the conviction below. Thank you.
Thank you for your arguments. Ms. Hardman, you have just under 2 minutes.
Thank you. I hope to make 3 points. First, about the case law. In Tarling, the Supreme Court said that the prior conviction evidence should be about his credibility for untruthfulness, not about his character. In Dennison, the Supreme Court said that the name and nature may be brought out when the defendant equivocates or denies the conviction. And in Candelaria, the Supreme Court said that the nature may be shown, but if the defendant admits his conviction, it's not necessary to prove it. I believe, I don't have Yeager with me, but I believe Yeager goes to whether the court has discretion to allow the prior conviction in the first instance. Clearly, the court must allow the fact of conviction. Beyond that, it makes no sense that the prosecution would have discretion to decide what comes in, and the court, the gatekeeper, does not have discretion. Second, with regard to the heat of passion defense, Mr. Waller testified that he testified a lot about his feelings, but he felt violated, angry. He had been trying to overcome his own victimization as a child by an older man, friend of the family, that he had a flood of emotions. He lost it. He snapped. To the police, he said there was no motive. It was spur of the moment. I snapped. And at trial, he testified that he acted under a heat of passion. even if this court disagrees with me on the harm of this error, this court should nonetheless issue an opinion explaining to trial courts that they do have discretion in this area and clarify the prior opinions of this court misstating the rule, which violates the original intent of this rule and the Supreme Court cases interpreting it.
In Yeager, the Supreme Court said, and I'm reading from the government's brief, quoting, "The word may does not bespeak a grant of permission or discretion to the trial judge to receive or reject the proof." Do we have to say more than that?
I believe Yeager is about whether to admit the conviction, the fact of conviction. Beyond that, the trial court should have discretion in deciding what it is or is not going to allow about, or what information about the conviction it will allow.
All right, thank you very much.
Thank you. I respectfully request this court reverse Mr. Law's conviction and remand for these questions.
Thank you very much for your fine arguments. Thank you to both counsel. The case will stand submitted, and a written opinion will issue in due course.